Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Tim Reedy, sitting in for Father Matt Malone this week, and joined by Carrie Weber and colleague Kevin Clark. Good to have you both here. And we will be joined shortly by our guest. We'll be talking about her article, My Daughter Has a Disability, I Don't Want Jesus to Fix Her, just in a little bit. But first, Carrie, we want to jump into another article that you've brought to the table that's gotten a lot of attention. We just posted it last week. A sort of Catholic's very Catholic wedding. Can you introduce the writer behind this piece?
Sure. So this piece was written by Tracy Wakefield, who is, you may have seen her in the on television lately, because she is the executive producer and showrunner of a show called Great News. It's a new sitcom. It just debuted last night. It is about a woman who works at a TV news station, and her overbearing mother gets an internship there. And she, God bless her mother, says it is basically based on her actual mother. And that, not the actual
internship. The mother portrayed in this article?
The mother who's makes in this piece, yeah.
And you get a glimpse of that mother through her article that she wrote for us about the process of preparing for her wedding. So she grew up Catholic in New Jersey. Her mother's very Catholic. She moves to L.A., Tracy does. And
is stripped of her religiosity almost immediately crossing the border in California.
She kind of finds herself, you know, liking some aspects of her Catholic upbringing and letting go of some others. So when it came time to get married, she felt like she would get married in what she called a Pinterest field, you know, somewhere where there's, like, I'm sure, mason jars hanging with little flowers in them and those succulent plants wrapped with burlap.
You never
that kind
get
of thing.
Them to look as good as they look in the pictures. That's all I know.
So this is what she imagined. And then she said her mother said no very strongly and was like, there will be no Pinterest field. There will be a Catholic wedding in a Catholic church with Catholic vows and all Catholic things.
And I like the church lady that stopped her from using two tickets to paradise as her wedding song.
So she talks, right. So Tracy talks in the piece, a sort of Catholic's very Catholic wedding, about her struggle to kind of let go of what she thought her wedding would be and then embrace the aspects of it that were somewhat forced upon her. But one of those things she was trying to hold on to was the music. She wanted, I think, a George Harrison song or something, like, to be the person. She was like, it's nice. It's tonally appropriate.
Yeah, no.
It's not.
There was a couple of Iron Maiden songs in there.
And the woman she calls Bev, who worked at the church and was in charge of this. No. Says no. She says here are four songs that are traditional songs that you can play. And as she put it, this is the hill on which she was choosing to die. She was going to the mat.
Battle of Bev. Should we give away the jokes?
Battle of Bev. Yeah, let's just quote all of her little quippy jokes.
Yeah.
No, it's a great piece. But, you know, she gets really, really caught up in this. And she talks about saying, you know, she was the kind of person who looked sort of askance at folks who got really into their wedding planning and were sort of like, oh, right. You're getting so materialistic and so caught up in this. And then she finds herself sort of really, really caring about, like,
every
the chairs and the
napkins.
Every
time you think you get away, they pull you back in.
And until she goes to pre-Cana, and she has this really moving experience there where she and all the other couples are saying their vows ahead of time, and not, it does sound a little bit like a Mooney wedding or something, but apparently they're practicing saying their vows, and she realized sort of that her wedding exists not just in that church or in her mother's head or on Pinterest, but in the context of all of these other couples who had said vows, you know, were saying vows with her then and had said them before and after, and saw it in the context of the whole church, which I thought was a really nice and moving revelation.
Yeah, no, and I will say, again, please go read this story. Cause
don't take our word for it.
I know we always say this, but really, please go read this one. Really funny piece. But yeah, that's the genius of it, is that in addition to having just a lot of funny moments, there's actually some wisdom there, which is just, you know, it's just a great combination.
Yeah, and I mean, there's this sense of tradition and the sense of her sort of individual versus society kind of thing, this dying to herself to be a part of this larger group.
Right. And it a unnamed New York parish makes an appearance, which we won't publicly identify because she does not. But I think the people who are in that parish know what
they know.
We're talking about.
They posted about it on Facebook. So we'll let them tell you about it. But it's a beautiful church.
It's funny, when Jeremy, our colleague, Father Jeremy Zippel, pointed us out to the story of this woman getting married at this church, because that's how this piece developed. We saw there was a story in the New York Times about this very cool wedding at this beautiful church, followed by a reception at this like really, really nice reception hall in Midtown. It just looked like the perfect wedding, like Mindy Kaling was there, Tina Fey was there, and you're like, gosh, just so perfect. And then you read the story like, oh man, there was a lot more to this story.
There's a lot of drama going on there.
The Times didn't get the whole story.
But we have the real story here at americamagazine.org. Did you find yourself getting caught up in wedding drama, Kevin?
Somewhat.
Years ago, not recently. Not Tracy's
well,
wedding
we
drama.
Didn't have, we
Your
didn't
own
have,
wedding drama.
Yeah.
How many years ago?
There was no electricity back then. So it was a lot simpler. You know, we were burning whale oil.
Well, how long have you been married, though?
Married in Nantucket.
No, how long have you been married?
I was married in 2000.
Am I putting you on the spot?
I was married at the turn of the century.
Turn of the century.
Yes.
So the whale oil was appropriate.
Yeah. And there was a lot.
Do you feel like
it
it's changed
wedding.
Between then and now? Like, in
no,
terms
I think
of,
weddings are
it's
always
just always been crazy.
Always crazy, and to a certain extent, however nobly you might approach it and say, I'm not going to be that, or I'm going to have the avant-garde wedding of my fantasies, as this young lady did. There is a certain, I don't know, the black hole of tradition. There's a magnetism that pulls you back to, especially if you're planning to get married in the Catholic Church, you do have fairly limited, you don't have the, it won't be like rose petals falling from the ceiling or anything. Your imagination has to be somewhat restrained. I mean, I've been to secular weddings that were, I thought, quite lovely. And I've been to Catholic marriages that I thought were a little gaudy and over the top with carriages and what have you. But, you know, what it is what it is. I think people who came to my wedding had probably still talk about it. There was...
Are we allowed to talk about why?
You know, Chicago police had to find a lot of missing people after that.
No bragging.
Yeah, I have a friend who worked as sort of the wedding coordinator for a parish, and she said she would often get a lot of really interesting requests. Like, can we release doves in the church? And she's like, how are you going to get the doves out of the church?
Yeah.
Like, what happens next?
Like, when you're at the reception, right? The rest of us are cleaning up.
We're now, like, trying to get birds out of the church. No, that doesn't work.
I'll say one thing about my wedding that we totally screwed up. Like, it turns out we picked the date. We picked the date just sort of somewhat arbitrarily. It turned out to be the day of the Chicago Marathon. I was able to secure some hotel rooms, but for a couple of weeks there, like, it looked like, oh my goodness, there'd be no room for anyone to come to this wedding.
You might have to bunk with runners.
Yeah, because every hotel was...
They're skinny. That's all right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the real important part of that, of the wedding and the marriage, is the family, right? Is forming a family, is bringing your family together. And Heather Kim Lanier is... a person who is here to talk with us about her family and the fact that she, her piece is called My Daughter Has a Disability, I Don't Want Jesus to Fix Her. And she's talking about in the context of someone who, you know, has in, you read the gospel and you see Jesus healing and healing and healing. And it's really easy to wonder, you know, why doesn't Jesus just love people as they are? Or, you know, I'm sure he does, but what does it seem like? Maybe that's tough. So here to talk a little bit about that is Heather Lanier. Heather, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're really glad to have you here. So could you tell us a little bit, I started explaining a bit, but a little bit about the thesis of your article for us?
Sure. Well, the article was less a thesis for a long time and more just a question. And so for a long time, the question was, you know, was Jesus a crappy disability advocate? Which is it's horrible to put the word crappy with the word Jesus. But
fully human, because, fully divine.
Right, exactly. Because just the past 2 years, I've been reading the daily office readings for the Book of Common Prayer, because I'm a practicing Episcopalian, and... you know, pretty regularly, like, Jesus was healing, like, Jesus was fixing people. And my daughter has a rare chromosomal anomaly, so she has a deletion on one of her chromosomes, And she's almost 6 years old. And so in the past 5 or 6 years, I've been reading a lot of work by disability advocates who notice the ways that people put pressure on people with disabilities to be fixed, you know, like, and I've noticed that with my own daughter. Like my first year with her, I would take her to church, and she was very tiny. That was really the only thing that people would notice necessarily at first, was that she was very small compared to other babies. She was born 4 pounds, 12 ounces. And the common comment I would get from well-meaning parishioners would be, don't worry, she'll catch up. Don't worry, I have a nephew who didn't walk for a while, and now he does, and everything's fine. I also got the comment, like, you would never know that my child or my neighbor's child has autism, or, you know, whatever it is. So the pervasive message I got was, like, people would want a person with disabilities to be able to pass as a person without. And then people with disabilities who are advocates or activists often highlight this as really troubling. And so I'm like simultaneously reading a lot of activists and trying to learn more about the experience of people with disabilities, and also like reading Jesus in the morning and seeing Jesus do exactly what they were asking people not to do, which is like the paradigm of fixing a person. So I just chewed on that question for a year or so, and because I had read Emily Rapp's Poster Child, which is a memoir about being a poster child. Emily Rapp was born, eventually she lives with a prosthetic leg. I forget the specifics of her birth, but she lives with a prosthetic leg, and Poster Child is about, you know, being a poster child and as an advocate for, like, somebody who's trying to crusade for people to, like, to fix the children, you know? So her picture would be on different places. And she writes about her struggles with that, and she writes about finding Nancy Iceland's The Disabled God, which is like a brilliant title, The Disabled God. And I was super drawn to it, and so I looked more into Nancy Iceland's work. And she makes this argument that in the end, because Jesus returns, as he returned at least in my church on Sunday, with these wounds, then he returns to show us that the wounded body, the disabled body, is the whole body, you know, fully human, fully divine. So that's my concluding thesis, although I'm still always chewing on, you know, aspects of the gospel when I read it, because, you know, there's a lot of healings in those books.
But Heather, that conclusion you came to after a lot of thought, and as you said, you spent a lot of time on this piece, is that actually something, as you write, that was kind of in your gut? Because raising a child who had this disability, as you say, every part of you knew that she was, as you say, whole and holy. So this mm-hmm. was something that you knew in your heart, but you were trying to think it through. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I wanted the Bible to echo what I knew inside. You know, I wanted Scripture to speak to experience, and I was uncomfortable with the fact that they were disagreeing. It seemed like they were disagreeing, and they do at times. So I think that's what I was chewing on. As I write in the first... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm just... The Bible has a... This was an article I read years ago and got me thinking in a good old U.S. Catholic magazine where I used to work. It was pulling apart sort of the anti-family messages in Scripture. You know, hey, let the dead bury the dead. You know, like, that's not your response, but get up and follow me, leave your family behind. And, you know, he, if you want to follow me, you have to abandon your family. So is this sort of along the same thread, the Jesus who you kept seeing reaching out to fix people as opposed to embrace and accept people?
Yeah. Well, he embraces so many other kinds of people, but it seems like if he encounters somebody who's ill, that the scene doesn't end, the story doesn't end until that person's healed, you know, or even raised from the dead. So, right. And there were some interesting arguments that my husband had posed about that, who's a priest, you know, about how it's like a rhetoric of the time. Like, if people back then saw the body and the soul is fused, then to indicate the soul is healed, the body has to be healed also. Yeah. And that's called something specific, but he told me the term, and I thought, well, I'm not going to include that. And now I forget the term. So some listener will know, and they'll let us know.
Yeah, I was really struck by this sense of, in some of the writers that you mentioned, people coming up and saying that they were going to sort of pray for them. And I was reading this about this in another blog recently about a woman who has a disability, and she was saying that, you know, someone just came up to her in the mall one day and said, "Jesus loves you." And and how she realized this was well-intentioned, but it came across as just kind of condescending, as though she would not know that, or as though someone else would not have treated her as though that were true. How do you find you're able to react when you hear some of the comments that might be well-intentioned that you were talking about? How do you respond to people, and then how do you handle that emotionally?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I guess I don't tend to get, maybe it's because I'm the priest's wife at church that, you know, and my husband is an excellent priest and an excellent preacher. And so, and his daughter, who is almost 6 years old and really a tiny 6 year old and is running around, she's walking around the church, you know, as he's preaching, there might just be this sort of natural, embracing of our kid at exactly as she is, because we do that, you know. So I don't get a lot of comments like that at church. I don't get strangers who say that either, because otherwise you'd just see my kid as small, you know, right now. You wouldn't necessarily know much else. And younger people would think she was younger. But I really want to, I try to pay attention to friends of mine who have disabilities who are really turned off by church because of their experiences. You know, so I guess I don't have specific responses because I don't encounter that issue, but I'm super sensitive to the fact that it's really common. It's more common than I realized for somebody with a physical disability to be told in various cities that they travel to by somebody there, some stranger, like, "I'm praying for you," or like, "Jesus loves you," or, and just how tiring that must be, yeah. You know, like how taxing to constantly be the recipient of these things and these prayers. And many people are agnostic, you know, or, you know, skeptics, and it doesn't feel embracing to them. And they may have already had experiences with churches that are not accessible, you know, like physically not accessible spaces. So this essay that I wrote for you all at some point was, you know, 3 to 4 times as long. So I was doing some reading about people's interactions and experiences in churches, and somebody had said that even the fact that she can't go up to the altar feels like a barrier, that like the priest has to come down and give her the communion separately. The sense that like the space feels like it teaches her that she should be different than she is.
Yeah. And even if
so
you,
you go ahead.
Even if you have the most accessible infrastructure in your parish plant, it doesn't necessarily mean you have the programming that people are looking for support families with members who have some sort of disability. We talked to Steve Riley a few months back, who works for the Potomac Community Resources and in Maryland, and he pointed out that something like 1 out of every 5 people in the United States has some sort of what are described as disabilities. Mm-hmm. So if you look around your church and you don't see anyone, that means they're not there. And the reason they're probably not there is your church is not being welcoming to them, and not either physically welcoming to them or programmatically welcoming to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's invisible disabilities too, which would make up a big chunk of that 20%. It's a common statistic, 1 in 5. So just because you wouldn't see someone with physical disabilities in your church doesn't mean that you wouldn't have any disabled parishioners. But yes, if you don't see people in wheelchairs, there might be a reason. You know, if you don't see folks with walkers, there might be a reason for that.
Yeah, there's ministry at some parishes. I know St. Francis Xavier Parish here, they have what they call an abilities ministry, and they have volunteers who are specifically there each week to welcome a couple of parishioners who are in wheelchairs and who come sometimes very far ways through New York on the Accessoride transit to get to this parish because they actually feel welcome there. And there is, and the ministry is, because Accessoride, which is the city's sort of van service for wheelchairs, so folks don't have to go on the subway, is not always the most efficient form of service. It's the ministry is to sit and talk with folks while they're waiting, because sometimes you know, you can wait for an hour for this van to come after Mass and pick somebody up. And to do that alone on your own, you know, out on a sidewalk would be a deterrent, right, from going to Mass at this place or anywhere. But to know that there's some people in your parish who care enough to spend time with you and sit there is going to probably make it more likely that someone will continue to come back and to feel nourished. And it's a benefit to everybody, right? You are, as a volunteer, are learning more about your fellow parishioners. And the folks that need the wheelchairs and the vans are learning, are not having to sit there alone. So it's just this real camaraderie, this real, the part of that revolution of tenderness that Francis talks about in his TED Talk.
Now, Heather, as I hinted at the top of the show, you're not praying for anyone to, as you say, quote unquote, fix your daughter, but you are looking for a different kind of miracle. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess I'm looking for the sort of miracle of a change in perspective. So in the ESA article, I talk about how, you know, after having Fiona, and her name is Fiona, and learning about her syndrome and kind of acknowledging my own resistance to that, you know, and realizing, like, this is how God made her, I started noticing the way that the culture tends to devalue people with disabilities, particularly people with intellectual disabilities. So, and you can see this kind of everywhere, but one of the places I often see as like the pinnacle expression of this is the ethicist Peter Singer, who's an Ivy League professor, who argues that he ethically argues his way into this claim that parents of kids, of babies with some significant disabilities, should be allowed to kill their babies because they won't produce happiness. So that's like an extreme example, but, you know, Peter Singer still works, and he still works at Ivy League University. So I just kept seeing, and I've seen throughout, like, all these expressions of what we call ableist attitudes, and certainly in the presidential election, I saw it with the reporter and Trump's mocking of him, and continue to see it in the threats to Medicaid and things like that. So,
is there? Do you think there's there's almost this utilitarian subtext to things now? There's this almost unspoken pressure on parents to not have children, you know, because the technology is becoming so sophisticated, prenatal testing, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There is this, you're almost looked at askance in society now if you choose to proceed with a pregnancy where you're aware of anomalies or difficulties that your child is going to have. That just seems to be becoming more and more, I mean, maybe it started out as something that Singer-esque idea was unspoken, but now it feels like people almost look at you critically if you choose to proceed under those circumstances.
I don't know. That wasn't my experience, but Martha Beck writes about that. She wrote a beautiful memoir called Expecting Adam, and she was pregnant with a baby with Down syndrome. His name becomes Adam, and she experienced a lot of pressure. She was an academic, and she experienced a lot of pressure at the university to abort her child. Mm-hmm. So I think even beyond that, I think there's a lot of pressure. And I wrote about this recently in an article called Super Babies Don't Cry, about pressure on women to make these perfect people, you know, and to, like, take all your DHA and do all these things right and have your natural birth and create this perfect person. And I think I argue that it's because we want to try to mitigate suffering, what we think is suffering, as much as possible. But I didn't answer your question yet, which is, you know, what would be the miracle? So to me, the miracle would be if somehow we all just didn't have this lens through which we saw people anymore. We didn't have this lens of, like, a good person is a productive person, or, you know, we didn't look at humans
and by productive,
the way we look
at, you know, they contribute to the gross national product in some significant way. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Like it's a, yeah, it's a good factory line item. Like the human comes off without, quote, defects, which is inherent in even our phrase birth defect, which is an absurd phrase. You know, we use it all the time.
Right. And it ties into a lot of conversations that our nation is having about end of life issues and euthanasia, because it, a lot of people argue that it can be a slippery slope for folks who have disabilities, that people, they could be pressured into ending mm-hmm. their lives early because they are made to feel that they are somehow not a full contributing member to society, and their humanity and the very value they have just as children of God is not fully recognized in that. It's just very dangerous. Also, I read your article, Super Babies Don't Cry, and I didn't know that was by you. That came up in my it came up in my Facebook feed. It was lovely. So it's not on our website, but I can recommend that as well.
Well, thank you.
Do you find that you are able to have conversations with other mothers about this topic as well, that from the perspective of a parent to other parents, to provide them with some kind of comfort or to find some sort of solidarity?
Do you mean yes, both parents of kids with typical kids as well as parents of kids with disabilities. Yeah. I think like these issues of like pressure to make this perfect person, at some point in your parenting life, you hit that and you fail at that. You know, like your kid struggles to read, or like, you know, it doesn't like making friends, or, you know, whatever it is, there's this moment where we are human, and then like that pressure, that fear that your child is not, you know, whatever, the super child, seems to bear down upon all of us in this culture. So I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but yeah, I think these issues are pretty universal to parents.
I think it's gotten worse. If anything, that Facebook is killing me. I can almost barely bring myself to look at the parade of perfect achieving children. Not that my children are not among them, but but they're not among them. So in some ways, it's really aggravating to go into Facebook and
and social media can be hard, because that's where people sort of cultivate an image of what their family maybe.
It's all fake, right?
It's not. I mean,
Carrie,
I'm sure people are actually happy, and
fake.
I'm sure that's true. But like, you know, like I don't post to Facebook very often, but I did put a picture of me and my son and my husband on Easter and just said Happy Easter, everyone. And like my son is wearing a adorable like Easter fedora, but what you can't quite tell is that I am holding his arms down like forcefully to keep him from tearing it off for the picture. Like 2 seconds later, we were all like on the ground. So there's moments before the picture and moments after the picture, and I think it's good to remember.
Baby's
fedora. The writer, the fiction writer, Andrew Ervin, E-R-V-I-N, he's trying to push this movement called, or he's catapulted this movement called Honest Facebook Day. It's a day where you just say the thing that you would never say. And I don't think he's picked a an exact calendar day, but recently he posts on Facebook, I think it's time for another Honest Facebook Day, don't you? And I wrote a whole blog post article about that once. There's this, I think Fiona's, my daughter's first day of preschool, We wanted her to like walk to school, or we were going to have her walk, but she wanted to sit in her wheelchair. She had just gotten a wheelchair, which she doesn't use anymore. But I really wanted the picture of her just standing, you know, even though she hadn't started walking yet. I don't know what I wanted. I was obviously trying to sculpt this image of the first preschool day. And she's like, Mom, I really like my wheelchair. Like, this is awesome. And it is an awesome wheelchair. It's like the nicest thing in our house. That thing will turn on a dime. You know, those things are mean and lean. And so I took this photo of her, and it's a great photo, and it's on the blog somewhere. I think if you Google like Honest Facebook Day, you'll see it. And I like confess to this, like, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, like I'm trying to sculpt this image of this kid. She just wants to sit in her wheelchair, like get over it. So it's a good movement. I hope it picks up.
Oh, we try that on our American Magazine Facebook page sometime. Yeah, I think it's good when we are reminded of the need to be honest about these struggles, whether related to disabilities or parenting or whatnot, because I think it helps all of us to kind of move forward together.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for sharing your story, Heather. Thank you for helping all of us move forward. We really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed being here. Thanks.
All right. And also, moving us forward, again, if we come back to Pope Francis. Let's go back to him for a second, because he's looking for...
Pope Francis, well, going back to our original discussion about his TED Talks, I think he was talking about embracing a world of us, right? And this is sort of what Heather is talking about, is getting beyond the distance of, you know, you and whatever your challenges are to us, being a world of us and embracing each other for exactly as we are.
Indeed.
And that revolution of tenderness phrase, I think we had an article with that title. It's been used before and was often used in conjunction with those photos of Pope Francis reaching out to people with disabilities, which have become so popular. And
right.
I guess that addresses one of the questions I thought about when we were talking with Heather, which is, if okay, you're not going to say, I'm praying for you, which seems like well-meaning, but is also deemed kind of insensitive. Like, how do you approach people in a normal way? And Francis has got it down. You know, he reaches out, you know, and he's just very warm with people. But it's not always easy for people who, you know, aren't used to having people with disabilities in their lives to know how to respond in a way that's genuine, doesn't feel condescending, but is kind of real.
Yeah, there's a very fine line there, right, between ignoring somebody completely and just being like, oh, well, I wouldn't normally talk to a person right now, so I'm not going to, or you know, trying to force something where everybody feels strange and awkward. And but I think
that's sort of the approach I
that's just an everyday conversation.
Yeah,
though,
really got nothing to do with people's differences, but just how I am.
Yeah,
that's my difference, I guess.
I don't know. Do you guys have thoughts on that? Have you tried to have those conversations before, or try to?
I have tried. I'll never forget how an arch liberal friend of mine. I encountered a woman who was blind. It seemed to me struggling to cross the street, so I helped her across the street. This was Michigan Avenue in Chicago. It was a fairly busy street. I got her to the other side, and my companion, one woman had left, kind of whirled on me and said, "You know, they hate that. They hate that." And you mean, because I had kind of grabbed her elbow to kind of guide her,
right?
And I said, "Well, I didn't know how else I was gonna guide her without physically touching her." And it was sort of, I got this mini lecture in how to approach a person in that situation. I'm still not sure if he was right or I was wrong.
Right.
I mean, so
yeah. Well, I mean, and
I
the
guess
thing is,
try to do what feels natural.
If people are individual, there's no they, right? There's no universal response that's good for every person with a particular condition of any sort. So it really will depend. Somebody might be like, yes, this would be really helpful. I would love help crossing this super busy street. And other people might cross that street every day on their way to work or the park or whatever. And they would are probably used to people saying, can I help you? And they'll probably
And I would err on the side of actually reaching out to people.
I would too.
Just ignoring them.
Right. If out of the sake of political correctness, you know, do you need any help? And sometimes someone says no or yes, and then that's
yeah.
That's
I would say
that.
Speaking first probably is a wise thing to do.
The New York Times recently had a very interesting video just showing somebody on a wheelchair trying to negotiate the subway system in New York.
Oh yeah,
and like going to the stairs and the elevator was out because the elevator is never working, and it was just really eye opening.
Totally.
And so I just doing those sorts of exercises to think, okay, what is it like for these people? And he said something, for example, like, I'm lucky because I have a wheelchair that's light, and if I'm stuck, somebody can actually carry me up the stairs.
Oh,
whereas,
wow.
Like, a lot of people have electronic wheelchairs, those things are super heavy. You cannot lift those things up the stairs. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, so we want to thank you for joining us, and Carrie's going to take us out.
I'm happy to, Tim. Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening. You can find out more about us at americamagazine.org, where you can subscribe. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can also give us a call to subscribe at 1-800-627-9533 for America and America This Week. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.